I remember going to my first homicide scene, and you had this whole career of just seeing all this stuff, and then at the same time, not getting a break because I had to deal with it at home too.
And I'm still learning about myself, and I think that's the biggest thing now is like, who am I?
If we're living in this stigma where big boys don't cry, like we don't talk about things, right? We can never get there.
In order to move forward, you have to go through it. You have to allow yourself to process it, feel it in order to get better.
I thought, well, I'll just be the strong guy for everybody, right? Like, that's the image I had in my head of who I was.
We came to a point where I didn't even care if I lived or died on the job anymore. It was just like, I just want the pain to go away.
Unlike combat veterans, we have sort of this 20, 30 year stretched out combat tour where you see these horrific, tragic things and they add up.
Even in small towns, there's more than what people think. Your first SIDS call, holding your first dead baby. It's difficult sometimes to make people understand that.
We found a lot of people that had committed suicide. Motor vehicle fatalities, drownings, fires.
It was critical incident after critical incident.
That's why my supervisor said, have a beer.
Yeah.
I'm like, how many beers do you want me to drink? You know, until I pass out.
95% of the time, we're not willing to open up. That's a recipe for disaster.
Welcome to Responder Resilience. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be reuniting three law enforcement veterans, retired Chief John Monahan, retired Chief Douglas Wyman, and retired New Hampshire State Police Sergeant James Steinmetz. They're three friends who were featured in the film Inside the Box, and we'll dive into topics like being our brother's keeper, how we show up for one another, and post-traumatic growth after struggles. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder TV, PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, all the podcast platforms. And check out our website, ResponderTV.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with John, Doug, and Jamie right after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job.
In this family, up to a quarter of 911 telecommunicators have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis,
while responders are quietly suffering.
In this family, many struggle with job-related stress,
burnout, trauma, sleep disruptions, substance abuse,
and relationship problems.
In this family, we can help the helpers.
With vital information and resources,
resilience strategies,
and success stories of overcoming the obstacles.
In this family, no one is alone.
Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rimley, LCSW, EMTB. Today, we're joined by Chief John Monahan, Chief Doug Wyman, and Sergeant Jamie Steinmetz, who were all featured in the 2019 Nantucket Project documentary film, Inside the Box. John Monahan is a retired police chief with over 20 years in law enforcement. He's worked as a municipal officer, state trooper, and police chief in New Hampshire. John presents on wellness, social justice causes, and police community relations. Douglas Wyman is a 32-year law enforcement veteran, retiring as the chief of police for the town of Sandwich, New Hampshire in 2020, and later serving as the chief of campus police for the Worcester State Hospital in Massachusetts. Chief Wyman currently serves as an investigator for the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health Office of Investigations. He's a certified chaplain and instructor at the Justice Research and Training Institute at Roger Williams University. And with a distinguished career spanning 26 years in law enforcement, James Steinmetz is a retired sergeant from the New Hampshire State Police. His expertise includes serving as a peer support counselor, firearms instructor, and criminal and accident investigator. He's excelled as a canine handler, field training officer, and has contributed significantly to training security services. Gentlemen, welcome to Responder Resilience.
Thanks for having us.
You guys did this film about 5 years ago, and it really kind of focuses on the relationships you have as friends and as peers and as brothers. I'd love to find out a little bit about how that all happened in the first place. What was the sort of inception and genesis of being part of that film Inside the Box? I'll start with John.
Sure, thanks. Well, I was the chief in Moultonboro, and Doug was the chief next door in Sandwich, and I had seen these stickers on the internet, and they just said neighbor. And so Doug and I sort of put our heads together and said, why don't we get these neighbor stickers and put them on our cruisers so people will sort of – it's messaging, right? How are we going to message to our community to see us a little differently? Because we both worked in small towns. And so, but what we didn't know is that the people handing out those stickers had this thing called the Neighborhood Project, and they were a filmmaking company. And so they got curious and said, why would a couple cops from New Hampshire want neighbor stickers? And so we told them, and they said, hey, do you mind if we come up and film you guys? And once they met us, they were like, are there more first responders like you? And I was like, well, I know of one other guy. And so Jamie entered the pack, and that's kind of how the three of us got together and how the film was made.
Anyone else have a perspective to add to that?
Well, it was very interesting towards the end of my career. And when I was out of work on a workman's comp for post-traumatic stress, really struggling really hard. And I remember posting a post on Facebook, which I usually don't do. And it had something to do with post-traumatic stress is real. Mm-hmm. And two people reached out to me, and one was John, and then the other one was my academy roommate checking in on me. And John and I've worked together, so I felt very comfortable with John. And he asked me, are you all right? And I said, no, I'm not. And so we kept our dialogue going, just talking amongst ourselves. And one day he says, Jamie, I want you to come over to my house. We're going to watch a film, and then we're going to talk about it. And trusting John and respecting him, I said, okay, I'll come over. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into. So, that was my perspective.
Okay. I know for me, it happened. The Neighborhood Project started just after I had several different things going on in my life. I had my son was addicted to drugs and living homeless. My youngest came out as gay and then as transgender. And then this is about this was in January or February of 18. So it was probably 5 or 6 months post my wife having taken her own life. This is also during the time that our communities were in the crux of an opioid crisis, and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on about how to show, how we were going to show up to work and how we were going to bring our communities together, because although we were small communities, John's community has a kind of divided community. Mine had a kind of divided community as well, where there's several different village districts. But not only that, but the stigma around substance use disorder at the time, deploying Narcan and stuff like that. And, the people saying, let them all die. And, we can arrest our way out of this and all this other stuff. And just trying to bring people together while we're also, the three of us, trying to manage our own struggles. So that's my perspective of it anyways. And I found it very, our conversations very, very therapeutic.
And to survive the career with a sense of longevity, that you don't crawl across the finish line, that you sprint across, you got to know what you stand for.
Knowing that we have additional stressors, that means we have to take on the responsibility of making ourselves more resilient.
And on game day, we must succeed as a team. When one of us succeeds, we all succeed.
Most superhero origin stories, they're all stories of post-traumatic growth. You're like the Hulk that's been exposed to gamma radiation, and now you have this super ability because of that trauma you've experienced.
Before you became a firefighter, paramedic, and EMT, whatever it is, you were a human. You started off as a human. That human's got to be taken care of, and then we can take care of other people.
We have a couple of clips that we can show from that film to kind of set up some further discussion. I'll play the first one. This one kind of talks about the cop box and the man box, and Let's play the clip and then we can talk about it.
My father was my role model. That was the box that he lived in.
We have a cop box that fits inside the man box. We're supposed to be even tougher and not show any emotion. We can't fit in there.
Interesting term, cop box and the man box. And visually, it really kind of, I think it's profound how it relates to how we live our lives as men and as first responders. John, what are your thoughts on the cop box and the man box? Like, how have your mental, emotional, and spiritual states evolved from the time the film was made and to where you are right now?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the box terminology really comes from there's some different organizations that study like how we raise young men up, and how I kind of got introduced to it was I got really tired of going to domestic violence cases, and I was like, why do these keep happening over and over again? What's the deal? And so I actually studied with Maine Boys to Men, and then in New York there's a Call to Men, and they use this concept of a man box, and it's sort of this limited window in which you're allowed to express yourself as a man. And when you sort of have conflict inside that you're not able to express in a more healthy way, it'll come out in dysfunctional ways. And so we'll often see that in domestic violence cases or substance abuse or those types of things. And so I got thinking about it because there's so much stigma around how we express ourselves as men, as far as asking for help, you know, being able to cry or express anything but really anger. So, you know, when I mentioned my father in the clip, and you know, he's a Vietnam vet, you know, and those guys are tough guys, right? And so I grew up in that world. And so what I noticed in policing was like when those guys get scared, they call us because we have this even like smaller, more limited scope in which we express ourselves because we tend to be tougher, right? And we tend to be stronger and we have to be. You know, but over time that stuff can add up. And, you know, and so my Jamie and Doug and I getting together was really about like not like saying we can't quite cram ourselves into such a small space. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to talk about things that are hard to deal with so that they don't come out in dysfunctional ways, right? So that we can deal with things in ways that allow us to have robust and healthy lives instead of just pretending like we're okay all the time and we're not.
Doug, what are your thoughts?
I think it's profound in that, you know, what we think or how we think we should act, behave, how other people think we should act or behave. And then not only is it, then add a police officer on top of that. And then like in my case with my son, you know, how that intersects as being gay and then transgender and stuff like that. So, I mean, we could be living in multiple boxes. But then also, you know, how we're accepted by our peers, how we're accepted by our colleagues, how we're accepted by our community as a whole. You know, is it an accept or is it, you know, we're going to discard you or ostracize you in some way. So I think it's a good way to bring about some awareness to people, particularly when you're dealing with, you know, when we're teaching mental health and stuff like that.
Yeah, Jamie, what are your thoughts on these conversations?
Absolutely. I think for me personally was, you know, when I got my ultimate goal was to become a state trooper. And so when I achieved that, you know, I was always told, don't complain. Everything is good. You don't want to put any negativity. And if you saw any command staff, if you were in headquarters or out on the road, and they would ask me all the time, Jamie, how you doing? How's it going? Everything is great, sir. Everything is wonderful. And in fact, it's not. I remember one of my supervisors, because I was asking, especially when I first started, you know, when you're dealing with a traumatic incident, how do you deal with it? And the response that I got was, have a beer. When I had my, I guess you could call it my final exit with a colonel, and there was a bunch of command staff, I said, well, Colonel, how many beers do you want me to drink? Because right now I could probably drink 12 or two cases and not, you know, be affected by it. and it's still, it's never going to make all this trauma go away. And so living in this box was, for me, I was wearing a mask. In the video, I talk about wearing a mask, and I have it on my, as a representative on my, a tattoo. And it's a mask that I had to wear. People had to see, I had to hold myself to a higher standard, and I couldn't show any weakness, especially in the public or even with my peers. Because like Doug was saying, you don't want to get ostracized. I did towards the end of my career. And I couldn't understand that because we're supposed to be brothers. Aren't we supposed to help and pick each other up? And that's not what I was seeing.
The three of you kind of had a book club format, and the film that you watched in the book club really evoked a lot of conversation that was deep and profound. Let's take a look.
My next door neighbor.
That was kind of my attraction to the Neighborhood Project. It's like a book club, but it's a short film.
When the film ends, we'll circle up and the conversation will begin.
We watched Acceptance, which is a huge movie.
When they operated on me, it was a very rare cancer.
It's not our habit to accept. It's our habit to resist.
I wanted to wake up and be a boy.
These other people sort of step out and say, you know, I just took a breath. All right, I'm going to be okay. That hit me pretty good. And then other characters hit the other participants, and they just resonated.
So it was, I apologize. When he was talking about wearing his mask, that's how I felt. Like I had to be somebody that I couldn't be myself. I had to be somebody else. You know, when I get my Punisher mask, that's what I was. I was wearing the mask of that.
So we'll start with Jamie. Can you describe like your initial emotional reaction when you first watched that?
Yeah, it still hits me pretty hard. Excuse me. Because I think a lot of us, we do that. We wear this mask that we're trying to give the perception that we're these tough men. Because maybe how we were raised and we don't cry. Men don't cry. And we have to be this tough image. So it was very hard for me to even discuss this because of that. And then again, I didn't want to do it in front of my peers because then they think that I'm a weakling and I can't handle the job. And that's not the case. I mean, what the three of us have seen over this career is just unbelievable. We try to normalize it by dark humor, and it's not, to me, it's not funny anymore. Mm-hmm. So we wear these masks to try to protect ourselves, and that's what I was doing for such a long time. And I was so afraid to take my mask off. But I always equate it to taking a beach ball and sticking it underneath the water. Eventually, that beach ball is going to surface, and when it does, it's going to come with a vengeance. And that's what happened to me. It all of a sudden, I couldn't hide behind my mask anymore. And watching that clip, I just want to give the guy a hug. Just want to give him a hug.
Doug, what was going on for you while you watched that clip?
That movie was just, you know, that woman that comes on and says, you know, it's not our habit to accept, it's our habit to resist. And it's, that was the whole career. I mean, I remember, you know, having just started and going to my first homicide scene in 1990 and, my first fatal accident and stuff like that. And then you have this whole career of, you know, to seeing all this stuff, and then at the same time having to deal, not really getting a break, because I had to deal with it at home too, where, you know, my wife suffered from anxiety and depression and it was never treated. You know, she came from one of those families that, you know, if you took drugs, you were crazy, and you definitely didn't talk about your problems with strangers. So, you know, we had our ups and downs. And so, I mean, it was like, I never had a chance decompress. So it's like I was always resisting, But, you know, you look back on it and, you know, you're angry, you're not sleeping. I mean, you can tell in the video that I'm probably about 100 pounds heavier. It just totally weighs on you. And then like when my wife died, you know, we were in that realm of being a first responder where we compartmentalized all that stuff and kind of pack it away in a box and put it up in the attic and, you know, it should be opened again. But when that happened, I mean, that all the ghosts came to visit. And it was, you know, it was a difficult time putting them all back where they needed to be. You know, and they don't come at scheduled times, you know, so it was really difficult for a while there, but through it all, you know, that's what that movie meant. And that's what's kind of what was going through my mind while I'm watching it. And, you know, and like I said, it was only like 4 or 5 months after she died. So, I mean, you know, I'm still experiencing it at that point. It's still pretty raw. At that point. So, yeah, so that's, you know, it was a rough ride. I remember, I think it was right around that time I had been back to work. I think I'd come back maybe a month or so after her death. And it was right around the time of that movie that, I had a test, and the test was that I got called to a suicide call. And that's kind of where I knew I was going to be okay. And that's the day that I knew that, you know, I wanted to do something else. And that's where the whole chaplaincy ministry route came from, was that day, being with that family. Because I could tend to them in no other way than anybody else could, because I knew exactly where they were.
Responder Resilience is your place for insightful discussions for emergency services professionals, including law enforcement, EMS, fire service, 911 telecommunicators, animal control, rescue squads, K-9 officers, corrections, trauma-informed therapists, and agency leaders. We bring you leading experts and influencers in emergency services, sharing knowledge and tools to improve the culture of wellness and to inspire excellence in leadership. Tune in live every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time for the weekly premiere on YouTube and Facebook. Or stream episodes anytime on ResponderTV.com or on your favorite podcast platform. Stay current with hot topics, informative content, and get valuable insights on how to lead a healthier life both on and off the job by subscribing to us on YouTube and Facebook. Responder Resilience is committed to our family of public safety professionals. Remember to like and subscribe today.
John, your thoughts on, you know, the book club, the film acceptance, and what was going on in the room that day?
Yeah. So, you know, Jamie had mentioned earlier, I was the chief in another town when he had posted that thing on Facebook. What I realized back then was that, like, we're not helping each other out when we're going through hard stuff, right? And so Jamie and I were patrol partners when we were state troopers. And so I was like, well, if nobody else is going to battle buddy this out with them, I will. So that was my thought. And we had been in touch ever since, you know. During the film, you know, I had my own, well, I didn't understand enough about my own mental health at that point, you know, I thought, well, I'll just be the strong guy for everybody, right? Like, that's the image I had in my head of who I was. That was the mask I was wearing, so to speak, you know? And so I was like happy that I had friends like Jamie and Doug that we could get together and talk about heartfelt things, you know, and work our stuff out. You know, what doesn't come to light in this film is that I also was a heavy drinker, you know, and I ended up getting sober later. But like, I wasn't in some ways dealing with my own stuff. And so, but what this film, that part of the film is a point in all of our lives, I think, that kind of blew us out of the box, right? Like we all start to kind of come alive after we've gotten together and shared at that particular point. And Doug and I, you know, went on to, Jamie moved to Colorado, and Doug and I got asked, otherwise we would have dragged Jamie along with us, but we got asked to design a course on mental health for Roger Williams University, where we teach it now. And so during this film, I think we were all kind of thinking, like, what's our path out, right? Like, we know that sort of this diminished existence of, like, the pain is not the place we want to stay, but we're not sure exactly where we need to go. But we also know that the tools we've been given were not going to be adequate to get us there. And so I think we were all on this path of, what are the tools that I need to create a better life for myself, you know? And we all kind of, but also sort of, you know, arm in arm, really, you know, like, well, let's, like, the, you know, the walking down the yellow brick road together, like, let's figure this out together. So, you know, that for me, it was this special time in our lives where we were able to sort of be there for one another during difficulty, but also provide, we'd already kind of gone through the hardest part, and we were working on, like, our path to recovery at that point, you know?
Great. I think that kind of ties into the next clip. It's a little bit about the community support and healing and conversations around this journey of post-traumatic growth.
We knew each other's problems, but we had never talked in depth about them.
I think I was one of the lucky ones. My community embraced me very much. They've supported me very much. Kind of circle around me and just say, okay, he needs a minute. He needs a minute.
That has the healing effect. And I think that that is what good conversation's all about.
So let's kind of do a little kind of rewind back to that moment and then fast forward to today. Doug, if you kind of reflect on your journey of post-traumatic growth since sharing about those struggles, how's your perspective on the importance of self-care and seeking help or finding the right tools? How's that evolved?
Oh, that was everything for me. You know, in the wake of that, I had, you know, New Hampshire Chiefs got me our guy to talk to, state police got me a person to talk to, and I had my own pastor and a friend that was a pastor. And within, you know, 36 to 48 hours, they were talking to me, and, you know, which allowed me to open up and be able to begin to process and, you know, work my way through it, which I think was, you know, that early intervention part of it was crucial for me. My town, you know, they gave me as much time off as I needed. They didn't count it against my vacation time, my sick time. They paid me my full salary during that time. They had fundraisers. It was just, you know, I remember one town person saying, well, you know, you've spent all these years taking care of us. Now it's our turn to take care of you. And that just, you know, It made it better when I went back to work that I knew that I had that support. And then finding my own counselor and having to be able to not only work through that, but, you know, just life in general and stuff that I had been through. You know, there was never, you know, a topic of the day or whatever. It's just wherever I wanted to go that day. And, you know, and it just lifted that load, and it was able to help me find acceptance, help me find closure, help me realize that, you know, because a lot of it is that shame and guilt in a suicide death. You know, we talk about it in our class where it's a, you know, it's a fundamental attribution error. You know, it's like I'm blaming myself for something that I had absolutely no control over. And it's you playing that woulda, coulda, shoulda with yourself. The end result was going to be the same no matter what I did. It was helping. That's what enabled me to be able to grow. That's what enabled me to be able to grow, to find some more, to find that resilience, and to be able to find a new purpose and, you know, just be able to move forward and live my best life, which, you know, which I'm doing. So, which is, which, you know, it enabled me to find to find love again, to be able to fall in love again, to get married again, to, you know, it's a greater appreciation for life, new possibilities, the whole nine yards. And it's just, you know, it's just a wonderful, it was a, not that what I had to go through was wonderful, but the end result was, you know, an experience that is like none other.
Thank you, Doug. John, your journey of post-traumatic growth since that time, and what was that like?
So, you know, for me, it was it kind of came later. You know, Doug talks about when he talks at the topic of acceptance, like the difference, and he often says this, is we don't have to agree to something, but we have to accept it, right? Like, I might not like it, but we have to look at sort of the brutal, honest facts of our situation in order to have a starting point, you know, because if we're lying to ourselves about where we're really, really at, then it's nearly impossible to get going. The other piece is the stigma breaking piece, right? Like, we have to be able to talk about this stuff. If we have to be able to suss through it all in order to discover that truth. And so if we're living in this stigma where, you know, big boys don't cry, like we don't talk about things, right, we can never get there. And so, you know, for me, you know, I really crashed at the end of my career. I had a lot of accumulated stress. The thing I would say about trauma, I had retired, and I actually took some post-traumatic growth courses through an organization called Boulder Crest. They do stuff for first responders, and they do stuff for veterans. Great organization. And I was actually in the trainer course. And I heard this definition of trauma as it's a disruption to our core values, whatever's sacred to us, that our coping mechanisms are overwhelmed. And then finally, a lot of stuff made sense to me, because I was not that affected by many of the things I saw on the road. You know, for some reason, I was able to process them well. But my child got assaulted years ago when he was away on a trip. And that was devastating for me, devastating. And I always thought about, like, the challenges we face as it's got to be this awful thing I saw when I was working, like the guy with the gun or the horrid car crash. But really what I realized later was that, you know, family and being able to protect my children is something so near and sacred to me because of sort of the way that I grew up. That happening to him is the thing that really devastated me. And I mentioned getting sober later. You know, I had to also accept that I was powerless over alcohol, right? And I went through that 12-step process. And when I did my ninth step to my son and I apologized to him, is when I really got the closure with myself and with him that I needed. Being able to say to him, like, I did a pretty good job taking care of you when that stuff happened, but if I had been, you know, of sober mind and heart, you know, not that I was drunk at the time, but like I was drinking to deal with my problems, I might have shown up for him a little differently. And what was surprising about that is instead of beating myself up with the woulda, coulda, shoulda, I found a deep level of forgiveness for myself. And so, you know, the journey of post-traumatic growth for folks is, this is who I thought I was. I go through something really hard and I discover this is who I get to be as a result of dealing with difficult things. So for me, you know, before, even in this film, I think I thought I was such a, like I'll help people, like I'm the helper. But I won't deal with my problems necessarily. And it wasn't until probably 2 years after this film that I kind of came to this place of, who I really think I am is somebody that helps other people to be able to show up in ways for the people they love in ways that I wasn't really able to, you know, until I wrestled with my own demons, you know, and that takes a degree of honesty and acceptance, you know. So we all have these different paths, and they are not like a one and done. It's a process of discovery and unfolding. So anyways, that's my two cents on that.
Love that. Love that, John. That's great.
Come on.
Check it.
Come on.
Jamie, so yeah, in your perspective, reflect a little bit on your journey of post-traumatic growth. What tools and resources helped you?
Absolutely. So when I was at my worst, and it was towards the end of my career, you know, I thought my administration was just trying to push me out. I didn't really think. I look at it now, and I have a clear mind of that they were actually were trying to help me. They were trying to give me some space and some time to rest. You know, but at that time, I'm like, you know, this is who I am. I'm a New Hampshire State Trooper. That's my identity. And so, but towards the end, it just wasn't good. And no one's calling me. No one, my wife was there, John was there, and then Doug. But it was very lonely. It was a suffering in silence. A lot of times I remember just sitting on the floor, just crying and not really sure why I'm crying, but I am. And, you know, it's, you know, when I was still active there, it came to a point where I didn't even care if I lived or died on the job anymore. It was just like, I just want the pain to go away. And I started to realize that I definitely needed help, and I did raise my hand. I have a friend that opened up a treatment facility in Vermont, Sonny Trevetto, who was a medically retired Vermont State Trooper, and I called him because we'd worked together in the peer support side before. Mm-hmm. And I said, Sonny, I need some help, and we had talked, and he's like, I got a counselor. So I reached out, and I found a counselor in Vermont. And I was going to her probably, if not 3 to 4 times a week, and usually really intense. There were some things that we could accomplish, some things that we couldn't. The EMDR, as I mentioned, just didn't work for me. But I do credit her and also my wife too, because I look back and I really kind of put her through hell too. And I credit them with sticking with me and not giving up on me. And, you know, just being there for me. They might not have the right things to say, but being there, listening, giving me a hug when I'm at my worst was amazing. And then I realized that I needed to leave New Hampshire because I was just traumatized by so many events throughout the state of New Hampshire that I couldn't go anywhere without seeing something, and it would just draw me right back into that situation. And my wife and I decided that, you know, let's move to a new area. I don't have any events that have occurred out in Colorado. I have family out here. And for me, being out in the woods, being out in nature was very therapeutic for me. And I found it really, like, this is amazing. But it's a constant, like John was saying, we can't just stop. Just because I moved, I'm still dealing with things. And I'm still learning about myself. And I think that's the biggest thing now is like, who is Jamie Steinmetz? Who am I? You know, for so many years, I was a New Hampshire State Trooper. That's who I was. And now who am I? So I'm working on that. And I have a good support group out here. And so that's been super beneficial for me. So, but I have pillars like working out, nutrition. I'm not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but the sleep recovery, the counseling, I even got back into my faith again, which has been extremely helpful. So those are some of the things that have helped me, but it's a constant work in progress. It's never going to go away. I can't because I could easily slip backwards.
Yeah. And you touched on the identity piece, which is huge in the retirement phase, just going from having that job and that identity and that life as a whatever we are, trooper, firefighter, paramedic, and going from there to like civilian life where it's totally different ballgame. So, you know, we talked a little bit about that offline earlier, and that's a whole other topic is retirement. Let's keep moving on this and I just kind of floated a question out there before we watch the next clip. So I know Doug and John teach this kind of stuff as part of your trainings that you do. What advice would you give to other law enforcement officers in navigating their own path towards healing and resilience, and especially around being able to talk about it? We'll start with John.
Thanks. Yeah. So if you remember that definition of trauma, it's a disruption to your core values to the degree that your coping mechanisms are overwhelmed. So one, I would be very clear about my core values, like what is most sacred to me, and make sure that whatever you're doing, you're living in line with what they are. So what you say is what you do. The other piece is the coping mechanism. And that means, and Jamie and Doug both touched on this, your body, your mind, your spirit, your finances, like those are kind of the four sort of resiliency factors, you know, and so, and they are a practice, right? We need to practice physical health. Like just because I worked out 10 years ago doesn't make me in shape today. I need to practice physical fitness. Well, I need to practice mental fitness. I need to practice financial fitness. I need to practice spiritual fitness. And I think you've heard all three of us talk about sort of this renewed spiritual and faith piece. And for me, that was a big part that was missing before, is that I thought I was the man. It turns out there's a whole other man out there that I need to be paying attention to, you know, in order to sort of guide me through times that I, you know, I might struggle in because I don't always have all the answers, you know. So I think of it as one, I need to pay attention to all the areas of health. And two, I need to make sure that I'm practicing all the areas of health in order to have strong resiliency. So when the tough stuff happens, I'm able to navigate it to the best of my ability.
Doug, what would you tell other law enforcement officers to help them navigate their own path in healing and get kind of on that road to post-traumatic growth?
Yeah. First and foremost, and John touched on it, and we all have it, it's that spiritual foundation. You have to have a healthy spiritual foundation because that's what's going to give you hope. That's where you draw in your personal strength. You know, it doesn't have to be my God or anybody, you know, it's just a power that's bigger than yourself that provides you for hope. From there, it's literally have, you know, it's, you know, you don't have control over what just occurred, but you have control over what you do next. And with that, you only have two options. And this is my coined phrase, you either get better or you get bitter. Okay. Bitter is, you know, going off into the darkness, into the abyss, and, you know, that's your substance use and all that other stuff. Being better means that, you know, you're gonna do the work. You have to go through, in order to move forward, you have to go through it. You have to allow yourself to process it, feel it, touch it, smell it, you know, and everything. You have to be able to go through that in order to get better. Asking for help and taking away that shame and guilt part of it is you're showing courageous strength by doing that and finding someone to help you through that and just concentrate on that, hike out of the hole. And so, you know, it begins with faith. You don't have control over what just happened, but you have control over what you do next. And then your next choices, you only have two, better or bitter. And just know that, you know, one way is an easier path. The other one may not be. It's the road less traveled sometimes, but, you know, but it's going to lead you to a way better spot. And I think all three of us are living examples of that.
Thank you. Jamie, I know you've had served as a peer support counselor and a leader in your organizations. What advice would you give to other LEOs in terms of finding the path to healing? And
absolutely. And I appreciate that. That's a good question. And again, I think the other two just really hit upon it. But, you know, for me, it's, you know, when I do meet, you know, kids out here that are looking to get into law enforcement, the first thing I say is it's a great profession. You're going to learn a lot. But the biggest thing is you got to take care of yourself. Self-care is going to be your first and foremost priority. And finding somebody within that organization that you can trust that is not going to, you know, talk to other members of the team and that you feel like – because, again, when we go to these situations, they're not normal. We try to normalize this. And I'm like, that's how it was, you know, and I'm looking at this going, no, this isn't normal for any of us. Okay, but I need to find an outlet, you know, somebody, whether it's a peer support team, somebody you trust that has confidentiality that you can really, you know, put it out there. And it's not going to go and spread it around a campfire or like a troop party or a shift party or something like that. and really just taking care of yourself. Because I can guarantee all three of us, when we first started the job, we were going to solve the problems and we were going to save the world. We were going to do the best we possibly could. But after going through one critical incident, it just chips away at you. And then when you accumulate so many more, I didn't even recognize who I was. And the faith part came up after we lost one of our friends who was a trooper, Drew Keith. And I realized that him and I, before he passed away, we had conversations about getting back into our faith. And I lost my faith because I couldn't understand why God was allowing these young, innocent people to die. And yet I would see other, you know, individuals survive and get multiple opportunities or multiple chances. And I was like, nope, I hate God. I don't believe in God. And once my friend passed away, then I had a law enforcement chaplain kind of really dial me back in, get me back on track again. And then from there, it's a work in progress. It's not just a one and done. Oh, I go to church or I read the Bible and it's all said and done. No, it's like you have to really put, like Doug said, you have got to put the work in. And sometimes it's not easy when you have to face these fears. But that's, for me, I worry about these young kids not having an outlet, having a hobby, having something that they can find outside the job, because it is, at the end of the day, it is a job, you know, and they're going to replace us as soon as we retire or as soon as we moved on, because what was explained to me was like, okay, Jamie, I think it's time for you to retire. And this is administration talking to me. We need your sergeant's position. Oh, that was a slap in the face. Okay. Well, that was a reality check. All right. So, and then of course, when you start doing that self-loathing, you know, you were like, oh, you feel like you're, oh, I guess I'm nobody anymore. So taking self-care is crucial.
Great, great points. Let's move on to the fourth clip here. And the last clip, take a look at this. This is going to kind of also tie into some of the topics around forgiveness and the sharing the stories. We'll take a look and then talk about it.
The conversation for me is kind of the culmination of my career. We were all these young recruits with crew cuts, perfect white teeth, and crisp uniforms. Raising our right hand, those are not the same people that retired. Some of them are very damaged people.
I know that there's forgiveness. Forgiveness not only of your loved one, but forgiveness of yourself. I completely love my son. I wouldn't ever trade him in for the world, and he's doing great. I can't be any prouder of him.
I sent my father a copy of the film clip that you sent me, and he, hang on. So he said it made him cry, and the thought of my father crying makes me cry. But he, what he was saying is it reminded him of when he got back from Vietnam and they would sit around in circles and talk. And he said he found great comfort in sharing his story with his peers, you know, because they were the only people that could understand that.
So much good stuff in there. I guess just as a jumping off point, John, you know, you guys kind of embodied peer support in these film clips, and those that are struggling to connect with somebody to talk about these deep, you know, kind of private things, like how would you coach them to find fellow officers or a peer that they can open up with and share their experiences?
Yeah, I think, you know, the stigma around it has changed a lot. Doug and I have been teaching our class for about 5 years. And I got to say, the first couple we taught, people were like, we don't do that. And now they're like, nope, we get it. Like, it's really changed a lot, you know, so it's easier. And the peer-to-peer networks are much more robust than they used to be. And, you know, so it was kind of an informal thing back in the day, right? Like, you just had your buddies and people you could talk with. But some of them didn't have the best advice, right? Some of them were like, well, let's have a beer. You know, my Uncle Billy say, have a beer and let the Lord figure it out, Johnny. And, you know, and so it was nice to have someone who cared about me, right? But I need somebody who cares about me that's got good advice and good resources. Doug talks a lot about And Jamie mentioned it too, having like a specialty provider. You know, I was teaching a class the other day and I joked that if you don't find the right therapist, by the time you're done with them, your therapist is going to need therapy. So making sure that we have, you know, people at our disposal that we can go to when we need to, you know, and talk with the right people. So, you know, having sort of the courage to do that. And I'm guaranteeing you there's somebody on your PD, no matter where you are, that's probably seeing a therapist and just not talking about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and if we can get people, and this is the box thing, right? Outside of that box is freedom. Like, there's nothing wrong with being strong and tough, but you also got to be able to step out and say, I'm doing this for me. You know, it's just writing down the difference between selfishness and self-care. Selfishness is when you put your wants before other people's needs. And self-care is when you put your needs before other people's wants. Mm-hmm. And we have to be able to step outside that box and put our needs first, because then we're able to show up for the people that we love and care about, for our coworkers, for our families, for our communities, as the best version of ourselves, right? And so whatever, you know, nut you got to crack to get to that place, and you got to figure that out. And it's different for everybody. The other thing I was thinking about is, you know, the light shines through the broken places, right? So even though we may feel broken at times, that those are the places where the light comes in, and that's where the growth can happen.
Wow. Love that. Doug, as we wrap up, talk about being our brother's keeper and how we show up for each other.
I think that we watch one another, that we're able to be confidants of one another, that we're brothers in arms, you know, it's we're each other's responsibility. And when we talk about brotherhood, you know, this is, you know, it's going to be tough at points, and this is the tough stuff. And you really need that person to those persons or people, you know, your 3 to 5 that will be show up for you and really be there for you, because even if you need help, okay, and let's say you get it, okay, it could be several weeks before you get an appointment. So, you know, that person that you can call at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, or, you know, just to say hi, you know, it's very, very important. And I think it's, you know, one of the hardest things you're ever going to do is be able to forgive yourself, and be able to, you know, like John said, you know, let the light shine through those broken pieces, because it's important. It's very important for us to be able to do that, to be able to show up, be able to have those tough conversations, you know, and in the end, you know, somebody that you can, you know, cry in front of, that you're not, you know, embarrassed to hug, that you're not embarrassed to hold on to, you know, to let that guard down and just let it go, you know. It's not only freeing, but it's also helpful for your progress forward. And it's important. It's, you know, it's the basis of chaplaincy. Basically, it's, you know, coming alongside people where they're at, and, you know, if they need you to walk beside them, you're walking beside them. If they need to sit and have a hug, you sit and have a hug. If they just need a second and you're quiet, but they know you're there, that's what it's about. Or, you know, jump on, I'm going to carry you. You know, we got to get from here to there. So I, you know, I'm going to carry you. So, and that's what it's about. That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thank you, Doug. So Jamie, final thoughts, about being our brother's keeper and showing up for one another?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, having moved out here, I've met some amazing people that have just been, you know, veterans or first responders that have been part of my 3 to 5 personal group. And and just to kind of reiterate, like what Doug's saying is, like, you know, there was one situation I can think of that a good friend of mine who was in special operations in the Navy, he's he just hugged me. That's all he did was just hug me and prayed over me. And that's all I needed. He can't, you know, he gives me some advice, but there are times where I'm not looking for that. I'm just looking for a hug. That it's going to be all right. Yes, it's hard right now, but man, I'm right there beside you. I'm on your left and I'm on your right. And that's, you know, what's helped me through is like, but then they can count on me. Like if they're having a bad day, they can call me and say, "Hey, Jamie, I'm struggling here. Okay. Sure. What's going on?" And I could just sit there and listen. I might not even know the answer. But if they know that I'm really paying attention, active listening, and hearing what they're saying, I think it's so, so beneficial. And I feel so bad for men and women that don't have that support group, that feel like they have to hold on to all this trauma and all this stress. And it's just it's a shame because it's not going to end well for them. But I think, you know, you find your brotherhood. I thought it was within the organization, but I'm finding, first responders at church or people that I run across in trainings that I do. And next thing you know, I call it having a cup of coffee. We'll just sit down and have a cup of coffee and we'll talk. And we might do it for an hour. And I've met some wonderful people this way and just really being able to share not just my story, but hearing their story, because everybody has a story. Everybody has something that they can contribute that we've all been through some tough times. And I think just, you know, having those coffee meetings just having a cup of coffee is powerful.
In the movie, you see John and I on the bench, and we jokingly call that our Forrest Gump moment. But it's indicative of the conversations that we had, and that's really important.
So as we wrap up, I wanted to thank the three of you, Jamie Steinmetz, John Monahan, Doug Wyman, for doing all you do and for really being so willing to share what you have shared today and in that film, Inside the Box. This has been a great conversation, kind of an experiment, but I think you guys have such a special chemistry that it works perfectly. And we've been able to capture, I think, some of the magic that you have when you're individual and as three brothers together.
Thank you, David. Yeah. No, we love each other, you know, and we're not afraid to say it. So.
Yeah.
We appreciate it.
Love them like brothers. That's absolutely 100% correct.
Thank you all for being here and sharing all this today. It's been absolutely my honor to be here with
you. The love is real.
Remember to like and subscribe. YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, be safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.